Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Laura Lippman, whose new book is Sunburn. We'll also hear from Clayton Delery, author of Out for Queer Blood, The Murder of Fernando Rios and the Failure of New Orleans Justice. Laura Lippman consistently tops bestseller lists with each new book, whether it's the most recent in her well-loved Tess Monahan series or a chilling standalone. She's won the Edgar, the Anthony, the McCavity, the Seamus, the Nero Wolfe, all the prestigious crime fiction, and she was the inaugural winner of the Pinkley Prize for Crime Fiction here in New Orleans. Laura divides her time between Baltimore and New Orleans, and today we're talking about her new standalone noir novel, Sunburn. Laura Lippman, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Always great to be here, Susan. Thanks for having me.
This book is the most fun I have had in ages.
Oh, wow. I love hearing that.
I mean, I couldn't quit turning the pages. So give us the setup. A woman walks away from her marriage, ends up in a small town, meets a man at a bar. Take us a bit along the way from there.
It's hard to talk too much about this book. I'd say by page 8, we're up to spoilers.
Yep.
But... Yeah, you've set it up beautifully. That's exactly what happens. I mean, on one level, there are two sort of literary influences or really ancestors to this book, forebears, if you will. The first is The Postman Always Rings Twice, that the idea was, what if a woman was the beautiful stranger passing through town? I'm always interested in how things happen if you flip something.
Right.
In that case, I wanted to flip the gender. Everybody knows and loves The Postman Always Rings Twice. I'm not sure that everyone is aware of how there's this whole thread in the book about domestication and how in the original novel, Cora, who works at the little roadside tavern, she wants to have a normal life. She wants to have a clean, pretty house. And Frank, who's passing through, that he chases that a little bit. It's hard. That's not exactly what he imagined for himself. The other literary forebear to Sunburn is a novel by Ann Tyler that came out in 1995 called A Ladder of Years, in which a woman abandons her family on summer vacation, just walks away from them.
I remember that book well, yes.
Women love this book.
Mm-hmm, they do.
I think I'm trying to compile a list of other books that sort of have this set up. Women are really interested in the idea of vicariously fleeing family through
novels. Exactly.
And, of course, Ann Tyler wrote this funny, warm, compassionate, funny book about that situation. But it also always struck me as a situation one could find in a noir novel. Who gets up and walks away from her family on a beach vacation, especially if she's a very young child, as the character in Sunburn does. And so I was looking at those two ideas, and I've been in a phase where I sort of like doing these literary mashups. Take some of this, take some of that. What do you end up with? And that was where Sunburn came from.
Well, it's interesting to me that noir conventions aside, one of the great qualities of this book is its tenderness. When you describe these two people falling in love with each other, it's all the more powerful because it's against such resistance and mistrust and fear. But you capture those tender little gestures and thoughts with great accuracy.
Well, thank you. And I think part of what's going on in Sunburn is that the reader, while in the dark about many things, sees right away that a love affair between these two people is not likely to end in a great, happy ending.
Right.
So the reader, I hope, it was my intention, and you know, it's up to the reader to say whether I achieved it, the reader is trying to figure out, okay, both of these people have secrets. Both of these people lie to one another. Which one am I rooting for? You know, if only one person is going to come through this novel relatively unscathed, which one do I want it to be? And in some ways, I hope that the reader is almost rooting against the genre.
Right.
Sitting there thinking, I don't know, maybe it will end happily. but if you know Postman Always Rings Twice and Double Indemnity, not exactly happy endings. I would say the closest Kane ever came to a happy ending is probably Mildred Pierce, and it's a pretty bleak ending as endings go. Again, I don't want to even spoil Kane's work for people. So there is this real sadness that casts a shadow over the book because savvy readers, and I almost feel like that's redundant because most people I know who read are pretty savvy.
Right.
They know in their heart of hearts where this journey is going to take them and the characters, but they just can't help rooting for these two people.
So talk a little bit about the appeal of the noir form for you, because it's something you go back to again and again. I've heard you talk about it. Did you set this book as a kind of formal challenge? Let me see what I can do with this. Let me flip the genders and do this. But there is something that you love about this.
I've always loved noir. And for many, many years, I had accepted the fact that I didn't have a noir voice.
Ah.
When I started writing back in the 90s, there was an almost reflexive jokiness. Like, I wanted people to like me, and I wanted people to like my characters, and I don't think I felt secure enough not to be likable as a writer. And in my mind, that meant being witty, offering people endings that, while not happy endings, had sort of a ruefully optimistic view of the human condition. The Tess Monahan novels, as a series, represent a woman who's shown again and again how bad people can be, but somehow she holds on to this idea that most people are okay, and I'd rather be an optimist than not. You know, over the past 10 years, I'd say, my work has gotten darker. I've been willing to write books that have pretty bleak perspectives, but I hadn't yet decided to risk writing a noir novel. I have a very specific definition of noir. It's my own, and it's simply that a noir novel is about dreamers that become schemers. People in a noir novel are pursuing what everyone wants in every walk of life. We want to be loved. We want to have money. We want to have a successful business. The difference is that in a noir novel, they're willing to cross a line to get those things. They're willing to commit crimes, to hurt people, to do what has to be done to realize those dreams. And as much as I love the noir form, I was still in my head the writer who started out 20 years ago. And then I began to think, well, wait a minute, I'm not. And maybe I can do this. And so you talked about formal challenges, and I love that concept. One thing I wanted to do with this book was write the tightest, leanest book I possibly could. The original Postman Always Rings Twice is most certainly fewer than 60,000 words. Most of my novels had run a minimum of 90,000 words. I think I actually went up to 110,000. I wanted to get this book under 75,000, and I think I brought it in at just under 80,000. And I tried to boil it down a little further, and I couldn't get another word out of this one when I was done. And I come from a journalism tradition where there was an old saying, you probably know this, Susan.
Yep.
Dear Mom, I'm writing you a long letter because I don't have time to write a short one.
Right.
It's hard to write lean. It's hard to boil it down. But I loved having that challenge for myself in the year that I was working on Sunburn.
Well, it's sleek and kind of glorious in that way, because you just are always moving forward. Now, one of the things that's so interesting to me is that so much of this book is about money, plain and simple. Although, as we all know, there's nothing simple when it comes to women and money, particularly.
Money is one of our great topics, and I feel that part of the reason that crime fiction has enjoyed such a renaissance. Crime fiction has always been with us, and it's always been good. But in the 90s, when I started writing and publishing, there was this whole generation of crime writers, a lot of whom were clearly influenced by not only the obvious suspects in Chandler, Kane, McDonald, and Hammett, a lot of them really loved and worshipped a writer named James Crumley.
Yes.
No longer with us and produced only a few books. But there was a group of us coming along who had read those books when we were in our 20s, and it was a bit of a revelation. It's like, wow, this is a crime novel. It also has all the qualities I would look for in a literary novel. That's pretty cool. Let's try to do that. And I think one of the things that crime novels long had as their great strength is that they're often about money. In literary novels, they've come back to it. But for a while there, you just never knew. Like, how did anyone make a living? How did they put food on the table? Were they worried about making their bills at the end of the month? And crime fiction has always been interested in money. And it's a great topic. We don't talk about it enough. Everybody's weird about it.
Everybody's weird.
I'm not exempting. People have different weirdnesses about money. Everybody is weird about money. For something that can be quantified, that should be so cut and dried, it involves the emotions so much.
The other thing I really admire about this book is that despite its leanness, you give the complete surround. It's extremely visual. You can imagine her clothes in perfect detail. You can imagine this apartment that she furnishes from thrift store finds and the references to movies, to music, to books, even the food. I mean, you feel the heat, you feel the atmosphere in the bar. You feel the pressure of the small town. So you manage to combine rich detail with that leanness.
That's a great compliment, and I'm certainly happy to have it. This is a book that it's rare for me. It's not the first time, and it's not unique, but it's rare for me to set a book in a completely made-up place. And Belleville, Delaware is a completely made-up place. Just this past summer, my mother lives on the Delaware Shore, and obviously, I go to see her a lot, and I was driving some back roads in Delaware that I don't normally drive down. I was with my daughter. We'd been to a water park, and we drove by a bar that looked so much like the Hi-Ho to me, a place that heretofore had been only inside my head, that I really almost did a double take. If I hadn't had my daughter in her car seat in the back of the car, I would have definitely stopped and gone in and checked it out. But so I think part of what was happening is I had to do what people call world building and usually use that term talking about science fiction or speculative fiction. But all fiction involves some element of world building, and Belleville forced me to really think about every aspect of the town. I'd actually set a short story in Belleville a couple of years ago that had been published online, so I knew a little bit about it. And once I was there, you know, obviously it has to be summer, it has to be hot, it has to be sultry, at least in the beginning.
The other thing I have to say is this book has the best ending ever, but we won't talk about that. So.
I'm glad you think that, though.
I did. It was great. We've been talking with Laura Lippman, whose new novel is Sunburn. You can meet her at the Tennessee Williams Literary Festival, March 21st through 25th. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for exact times. Laura, thank you so much.
Oh, Susan, thank you for the conversation. I'm so glad you liked the book. It means the world to me.
I'm just a scarecrow without you. Baby, please don't disappear. I beg your pardon, dear.
Clayton Dellery is a retired teacher from the Louisiana School for Math, Science, and the Arts in Natchitoches. His book, The Upstairs Lounge Arson, was named Humanities Book of the Year by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities in 2015. Today, we'll be talking about his new book, Out for Queer Blood, The Murder of Fernando Rios and the Failure of New Orleans Justice. Clay Dellery, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
At the very beginning of this book, you write about learning of the mass shooting at the Pulse Club in Orlando.
Yes.
And this text you got from your sister. And that was such a moving moment. That was such a fine starting place for this meditation. So I wonder if you'd talk just a little bit about that moment.
I was at work on this book, which is the story of a gay man being murdered for no other reason than because he was gay. And then I got that text from my sister, and it just said, it looks like you have another book to write. And I had no idea what she meant, but I knew that I needed to turn on the television and see what was on the news. And it was about the Pulse nightclub massacre in Orlando. And at that time, the known death toll was fairly low. But throughout the day, every time I turned in, it got higher and higher and higher until it finally settled at 49. Until that happened, the upstairs lounge arson had been the largest mass killing of LGBT people in American history, and the Pulse nightclub massacre shattered that record by a double-digit margin.
Right.
So it was completely shocking. And as it happened, a week later, I was marching in the Gay Pride Parade here in New Orleans with the LGBT Plus Archives Project. And the city just turned out in amazing ways to show support for the people in Orlando who had died, for their survivors, and for the LGBT community here in New Orleans.
Tell us a little bit about Fernando Rios and his story and how you learned about him.
Fernando Rios was a Mexican national who worked as a tour guide, and he was in New Orleans leading a group of doctors and their wives on a trip to the city. He was only here for a few days, and at the end of a day of work, he had gone out and he found himself at Café Lafitte in Exile, which then, as now, is a gay bar on Bourbon Street. When he was in Café Lafitte, he started flirting with a handsome young man who almost certainly propositioned him or made some sort of promise of sexual activity and led him outside. This young man was actually straight, and he and two friends were out on a mission that night to, the term they used was roll a queer. The verb to roll was used pretty much like we use the verb to mug now.
Right.
So they led Fernando Rios into Père Antoine Alley, which back then was much darker at night, and people who lived in the quarter were allowed to park in Père Antoine Alley. So there were lots of parked cars in and around the alley, and it created lots of blind spots, and it was dark and secluded. And they beat up Fernando Rios and beat him so severely that he died of his injuries.
And we should say this is in 1958.
This is in 1958. And at the time, Mayor Chet Morrison, aided by the police chief, Provosti Dayries, was engaged in an official municipal effort called the Drive Against the Deviants. Their stated goal was they wanted to eliminate homosexuality from the city of New Orleans. It didn't work. But it was going on at the same time that the three young men who killed Rios were going to trial. Their defense was that they had to beat him because he had made an indecent advance. The fact that one of them had gone into the bar looking for someone to make an indecent advance was not seriously questioned during the trial. But City Hall clearly saw that their defense played into the narrative of a homosexual threat that they were trying to advance so that they could pass a package of six ordinances designed to eliminate gay people from the city. And so at the same time that news coverage was ramping up concerning the trial that was about to happen, City Hall was also heavily publicizing these six new ordinances that they wanted to pass.
What a time. What a time in our city's
history.
So there were several things complicating the possibility of getting justice for Fernando Rios. I mean, part of it was that he was a Mexican national.
Yes. This was a time of very intense anti-Mexican prejudice. There was fear of a wetback invasion. Eisenhower was deporting people of Mexican ancestry, some of whom were actually legal residents and in some cases citizens. But he was forcibly deporting them in a move called Operation Wetback. And the anti-Mexican prejudice surfaces pretty blatantly in the news coverage. There are passages in the State's Item, for instance, covering the trial, where Fernando Rios isn't even mentioned by name. He is just referred to as the Mexican. You know, then the Mexican made an indecent advance. So the anti-gay prejudice and the anti-Mexican prejudice were both working against Rios. He wound up being put on trial in the trial that was supposed to be about finding justice for his death.
It took years to track down the records to reconstruct this trial. And you even ran into some post-Katrina difficulties in recovering them, didn't you?
I did. The transcripts of the trial were housed on the ground floor of the criminal court building at the corner of Tulane and Broad, and that flooded during Katrina. So anything that was on that ground level was destroyed. Fortunately, the newspapers covered the trial in great detail, and so I was able to reconstruct what happened during the trial from the news reports. And fortunately, a lot of the docket files, the various things that lawyers had to file in advance of the trial itself, had been put on microfilm and sent to the Louisiana State Archives before Katrina. And so there were a lot of documents there that I was able to unearth that proved very helpful.
Well, I have to say, these are tragic stories. They're painful to read. I can't imagine what it takes to write them. And so what is it that sustains you as you commit to something like this? Because you are entering the darkness of homophobia.
Yeah, and it's been pretty dark. The Rios book actually wound up being more difficult than writing the book about the upstairs lounge fire, which is kind of counterintuitive because when I was writing about the upstairs lounge, I was writing about the deaths of 32 people.
Right.
And even though there was a lot of blatant homophobia connected with that story, there were heroic figures and heroic moments. You know, Father Bill Richardson of St. George's Episcopal here in New Orleans really stuck his neck out and hosted a memorial for the victims 24 hours after the fire, to the great displeasure of the Episcopal bishop and to the great displeasure of his own vestry board, mm-hmm. who wanted him to resign. Reverend Troy Perry, founder of the Metropolitan Community Church, came in from out of town, as well as a number of other gay activists, to try and provide support that wasn't coming from anyone locally, for the most part. So there were heroic moments. With Fernando Rios, though, there were no corresponding figures. He was a lone man who was beat up and left to die. And the newspapers, City Hall, pretty much anyone with a voice, was dismissing him as a Mexican pervert who was threatening fine, upstanding young local men mm-hmm. who had beat him up for a lark and killed him for a lark.
So how do you feel when you finish a book like this? Do you feel...
Oh, I'm glad it's done.
But really, I mean, you've done something. You've brought this person back to life.
I hope so. I guess my main motivation for this book is, since really nobody spoke up for him at the time of his death, I wanted to do it, mm-hmm. even though it was 60 years later.
So 60 years later, how do you feel the climate is now? How much better? How much do we still have left to do?
I did the bulk of the research in 2015 and 2016, and throughout the time that I was doing the research, I kept having these weird feelings of deja vu, because I would spend my days in the New Orleans Public Library reading newspapers from the 1950s, trying to figure out what else was going on around the time of the Rios killing so I could put it into a context. And I would read stories saying that Mexicans were crossing the border and importing poverty, crime, and disease. And then I'd come home and turn on the news, and there was Donald Trump saying that Mexicans were murderers, rapists, and drug dealers. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s, it was quite common to read newspaper articles that were warning that homosexual men were lurking in public restrooms just waiting to molest children. And then I'd come home and turn on the news, and various presidential candidates were talking about the threat of transgender people lurking in public restrooms waiting to molest children. Mm-hmm. There's no question that there has been a lot of progress. LGBT people can serve in the military now. They can be legally married. I can write a book like this and talk about it on the radio without worrying about all kinds of social or professional repercussions. But at the same time, there is a core of animus against all kinds of populations that really has not changed much since the 1950s.
Sigh.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it's a very courageous book. You know, writing it was an act of great courage.
Oh, thank you.
I think. We've been talking with Clayton Delery, author of Out for Queer Blood, The Murder of Fernando Rios, and The Failure of New Orleans Justice. You can meet him at the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival, March 23rd through 25th. Check out sasfest.org for exact times. Clay, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Me too. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Don Quixote Book Club discusses parts 1 and 2, chapters 1 through 14, Monday, February 26th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Thomas Bonner and Judith Bonner discuss and sign the new edition of Sherwood Anderson and other famous Creoles. Tuesday, February 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, 2727 Britannia in New Orleans. Jenny Merrill, Director of Education at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, discusses African influences on Southern food traditions. Wednesday, February 28th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library, 725 Pelican Avenue, sponsored by the Friends of Hubble Library. Radley Malko and Tucker Carrington discuss and sign The Cadaver King and The Country Dentist. Friday, March 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books, 513 Octavia Street in New Orleans. The Friends of the Terrebonne Parish Public Library hold their 15th annual Jambalaya Writers Conference, March 3rd at the Main Library in Houma. Featured guests this year are horror writer R.L. Stine, Jocelyn Jackson, Melissa Marr, Louisiana poet laureate Jack Bedell, David Middleton, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, Katie Simpson Smith, Lady Hubbard, Bill Lofelm, Liz Talley, and many more. For ticket information, go to mytpl.org to register. Novelist Bill Lofelm is teaching a series of creative writing classes at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop, 631 North Carrollton in New Orleans. Coming up Sunday, March 4th from 2 to 4, Be Where You Are, Setting and a Sense of Place. And then Sunday, March 11th, TikTok, A Look at Suspense, Structure, and Pacing. For more information or to register, reach out to Bill at nolabill@cox.net. Bruce Deer signs his book for beginning readers, Dragons of New Orleans. Sunday, March 4th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop, 2727 Britannia, New Orleans. Make your plans now to attend the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 21st through 25th. Headquartered at the Hotel Monteleone and taking place at various locations throughout the French Quarter. The schedule is now available at tennesseewilliams.net. Also, over the same weekend, Saints and Sinners, the LGBTQ Literary Festival, will celebrate its 15th anniversary at the Hotel Monteleone. Check out sasfest.org for that schedule. The Historic New Orleans Collection and the City of New Orleans 2018 Commission's Cultural and Historical Committee present Making New Orleans Home, a tricentennial symposium, Thursday, March 8th through Sunday, March 11th at locations throughout the city. Visiting authors include Isabel Wilkerson, Walter Johnson, Cokie Roberts, and many others. The entire event is free. Visit hnoc.org for the complete schedule. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.